Shore Shame Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Hello, everybody. This is Bill, and we want to welcome you to this Torah portion, which is called Behar. And Behar means in the mountain or in the mount. And this is taken from Vayikra or Leviticus chapter 25, verse 1 through chapter 26, verse 2. And where in the previous Torah portion, we saw the cycle of the sacred seasons that is being continued in this Torah portion. In the previous Torah portion, we dealt with the weekly Sabbath, Shavuot, which comes at the end of 7 weeks, and all of the festivals that occur in the seventh month, the emphasis being on seven in many of those cases, because seven denotes completion. Well, in this Torah portion, we're going to take a look at the sabbatical year, or Shemitah in Hebrew, as well as Yovel, or the Jubilee. The Shemitah comes at the end of a week, or a seven of years. 6 years you work the land, and the seventh year you let it rest. And the Yovel, or the Jubilee, comes at the end of a week, or a seven, of the sabbatical years. And so, again, the emphasis being on the seven. Now, during the sabbatical year, of course, the land was to lie fallow, and it was to be released from cultivation. Because one of the things that this teaches is that the land is not the absolute possession of man. In fact, the land of Israel is God's land. And so this instruction, where the sabbatical year is concerned, where the Yovel is concerned, it counteracts the natural inclination for a person to see the land as being mine or being my possession. It is a gift, actually, that comes from the Creator. And it is a gift whereby we can work it, and if we work it, we can reap the bounty. But the land is His. And so in this, it also teaches us that life is really about denying oneself the goal of material gain, that we may obtain spiritual growth. Kadosh, or being set apart or holy, really, as far as I'm concerned, equates to self-denial. And so these instructions, and particularly where it relates to the land and letting it rest. And as a man, it would go against everything in you to not be at work, not being productive. And yet, in that rest that we see in the land every 7 years, and in the Yovel, and the release that comes at Yovel, even how we rest on the seventh day, we're not counteracting being productive. As a matter of fact, it aids to our production. It's just that it's spiritual growth and maturity that is taking place so that we can continue to do the physical things that we need to do to live and to exist in this world. And so it is a gift from the Creator that He gives us the land, but it is also a gift from the Creator to give us these times of rest. We teach, or He teaches us, that we must deny our inclinations and our wants in order that His standards, His principles can grow and mature in our lives. And so the spiritual helps us to be able to live in a natural material world. So again, just as we were told to sow and reap for 6 years and let the land rest on the seventh, so too we are told to work 6 days and to rest on the seventh. Because these spiritual goals and the spiritual growth that comes by obeying His commands to rest and to let the land rest actually adds the purpose to our work and our toil. Now, in chapter 25, verse 2, it says, when you come into the land, that the land was to rest on the seventh year, or on the Shemitah. And so we could make the argument that the sabbatical year of letting the land rest is only technically enforced when you are in the land of Israel. Now, my opinion is that the principle applies wherever you may be, but nevertheless, it is an absolute command that when you are living in the land of Israel, that this is what's supposed to happen. So, the land is to rest. It's not to be tilled, or you're not to allow anyone to till it for you. It's to be a complete rest. And so, as I said earlier, this serves the same purpose for the land as the seventh day or the Shabbat is to his people. Both teach that God is the primary force in the universe and not Mother Nature, as people like to say. And both of these commands testify that God is the one who created everything in 6 days, and he rested on the seventh. The years of the Shemitah cycle allude to the 6,000 years of history, which will culminate in the Shabbat, or that is the 7,000 year, this ultimate Shabbat, which is going to be a period of peace and tranquility. And so the Shemitah is something that serves a practical purpose and yet also serves a spiritual purpose and is in fact prophetic in many ways. And so we see that in this particular case, the soil itself is devoted to God and is being placed in service to God by helping the poor and by helping the animal creation. In Exodus chapter 23, verses 10 and 11, it says, 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its produce, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field may eat. In like manner you shall do with your vineyard and your olive grove. And so again, the Shemitah cycle teaches us that this is in service to God. God is enlisting his creation, the land, which is his, into his service to help the poor and to help animals in his creation. Now, it's interesting to consider that the soil is what you and I came from. We were created, or our bodies were formed from the dust of the earth. And so the soil responds to our obedience or our disobedience. In other words, when Israel obeyed God's commands, the land provided for them. But when they disobeyed God's commands, the land did not provide for them. And so again, that we come from the dust of the earth, and when we produce good fruit, obeying the commands, then the dust from which we came responds accordingly. But when we who were formed from the dust of the earth do not produce good fruit, or we don't produce fruit at all, then the dust from which we came responds accordingly by not producing its fruit either. And so the sabbatical year plays a role in painting that picture for us, because as we see in the Torah, because they didn't obey the Shemitah, then they had to be exiled from the land, and then the land is going to be recompensed for its Sabbaths. But we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves there. So it's just an interesting notion that not only does God bring his people into his service, but he brings all of his creation into his service. And again, in the Shemitah, that is to help the poor among us and to also help the beasts of the field that they may eat. Now, the sabbatical year was also utilized in his service for the national educational needs of the people of Israel and to acquaint the people of Israel with the Torah, as we read in Deuteronomy 31, beginning at verse 10. And Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, at the appointed time in the year of release, at the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, you shall read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Gather the people together, men and women and little ones, and the stranger who is within your gates, that they may hear and that they may learn to fear the Lord your God and carefully observe all the words of this law, and that their children, who have not known it, may hear and learn to fear the Lord your God as long as you live in the land which you cross the Jordan to possess. And so, during the sabbatical year, during the Shemitah, we see that the words of the law were read for everyone to hear with the express purpose of making it known particularly to those people, those children, who had not heard it, so that they too may hear it and learn to fear God. So, it's again accentuating the fact that where our perception would be by letting the land rest and not tilling it and not harvesting, etc., that that's not being productive. And that to just sit by and let this happen is counterproductive to life. But in reality, by letting the land rest, and thus us resting from that part of our toil, and then concentrating on learning His Torah, teaching our children His Torah, letting them hear the words of the Torah, then what we are doing is not counterproductive, but actually is productive, because in developing our spiritual life, it makes it possible for us to exist in a physical, material world. Because how much more difficult is it to face the challenges of life in a material world if you do not have any spiritual strength to draw upon? So just as the weekly Sabbath is a time of study and a time of prayer, a time of spiritual renewal, so too the Shemitah, the sabbatical year, is to produce that kind of spiritual growth. Now in verse 4 we see that this sabbatical year came in the seventh year, and it is also understood that it actually began in the seventh month of the year after the harvest had been brought in. So that's the seventh month of the seventh year is when the Shemitah, or the sabbatical year, would begin. Now in verse 6 it tells us that Sabbath produce, that will be food for you, which is to say that everything that grows of itself is to be food for you. But while it can be used for food, it is not to be stored, because you're not to harvest it. It is a situation where you could go, and if something is growing of its own accord, you could take it off of a tree or take it out of a field and you could eat it. But you couldn't harvest to store, because the land is supposed to rest. And keep it in mind that this is also to serve to help the poor of the land and the beasts of the field. Now it is said that in Israel, grain that grows of itself is not a very uncommon thing, and so I will just take that for granted. But obviously it tells us this for a reason. So again, while you're not to sow, while you're not to reap, while you're not to harvest, you can use that which grows of itself for food. But I would guess, and what this means really, is that if you're walking down the street, walking down the road, and you see something growing in the field and you're hungry, you could take it out and eat it. Or if something's hanging off a tree, you could pluck it off and eat it. But you're not to harvest and then take it into your storehouse. In verse 8, it tells us that they were to number 7 of these sabbatical years, or the Shemitah. And when they totaled 7 of these 7s for a total of 49 years, then that's going to accomplish something. That's going to put them towards something else that lends to rest. Of course, 7, as I said, represents completion, and it represents a cycle of completion in creation. You have 7 days, you have a Shabbat. At the end of 7 weeks, you have Shavuot, or Pentecost. In the seventh month, with its Tishrei, you have the High Holy Days. After 7 years, you have the Shemitah. After 7 of those 7s, you have the Yovel. So when they counted 7 of these Shemitah, 7 of these sabbatical years for a total of 49 years, of course, the next year was Yovel, or Jubilee. And of course, in that year, we understand that Hebrew slaves, along with their families, were emancipated. They were set free. They were released. And the property, and there are some exceptions that are spelled out in the Torah for us, but properties and inheritances would revert back to its original owner. Now, one of the purposes that this is to serve is a safeguard against perpetual poverty and against the monopolization of property by other people. And so it prevented all this property from accumulating in the hands of the few. Because if it were not restored back to the original inheritor, there would have been two primary classes of people, very rich and very poor. And so I'd like to point out here, as an American, that if we had chosen to follow the rules set forth in the Torah as it is, or as it pertains to the year of release or Yovel, then perhaps we would not be having the class warfare that we're having right now. Because there are people who believe that there are the very rich and the very poor, and that the very rich should give against their will to the very poor, and that the very poor are entitled to it simply because they are very poor. Well, what we have in the Yovel is something that would have prevented that kind of a situation. If for whatever reason you had to sell, and you don't, as we're going to get into in a minute, you don't sell the property per se, but the harvest the property can produce. But if you were unable to redeem it, of course, then in the year of Yovel, you would get it back, or your family would get it back. In other words, you'd get another chance. But when you don't do that, then you can end up with a small group of people monopolizing the property, and then you've got a large class of people who are perpetually poor. Now, the observance of this command was so important to the Creator that, as we alluded to earlier, non-observance of this command would result in national devastation. In fact, in Ezekiel chapter 7, one of the signs that Ezekiel mentions as being the reason for the end of the people of Israel at that time is their failure to observe the Shemitah, or the seven-year sabbatical cycle, and the time of release, or the time of Yovel. In fact, in the next portion, Bechukotai, we see that disobedience to this particular command results in exile, so that the land might be repaid for its Sabbaths. So failure to observe the Shemitah, and by extension, the Yovel, also results in exile. In verse 9, a shofar was blown to announce the year of Jubilee, and that occurred on the day Yom Kippur. Of course, Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement. Now, the shofar blast at this time was identical to the teruah of Yom Teruah, which is the Feast of Trumpets. So it's just to show that there is significance to the idea of what Yom Teruah is, that is to announce to the spiritually slumbering that they are to awaken, spiritually speaking. Likewise, when you hear the blast of the shofar at the year of Jubilee on Yom Kippur, that is to announce that those who have been in bondage to poverty, or those who have lost their inheritance, which would be equivalent to spiritual slumber, that they are to awaken to the fact that now you have a new chance. You have a chance to begin again. The word Yovel, translated as Jubilee, in fact means sounding the shofar. And thus, that's how we get the name Yovel. And so it is to be synonymous with the sounding of the shofar. The Yovel, the Jubilee, and Yom Kippur have much in common as well, because both symbolize a new birth. And that they both symbolize a new birth means that they both provided an opportunity for a new life. In verse 10, we see that at the time of Yovel that we are to proclaim liberty throughout the land, because in that time all slaves, all servants are freed and are to return to their inheritance, to work for themselves, and not to be in servitude to anyone else. And by the way, this applied even for those who refused to go out in the seventh year, that is, those bond servants. They were released. Everybody was released. And everyone returned to their ancestral heritage. And that's when the original division of the land was restored. And so what that insinuates to me is that in the year of Jubilee, that is when Messiah releases the earth from this curse that it's been placed under and this bondage of corruption, that it would be so specific that the original division of the land is going to be restored. That is, the land that he deeded to Israel, and according to the tribes, is going to be restored per his instructions. And one last little footnote here in verse 10, when it says proclaim liberty throughout the land, just kind of an interesting point, that is the verse of scripture that is inscribed on the so-called Liberty Bell that is in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. But at any rate, in the Yovel, the heritage that it speaks of that is returned and restored, that is speaking of the land that was allotted to a particular family as a permanent heritage. Because what we understand in this is that the land and the family that was placed on that land and that inheritance, they were entwined with one another. They were part of the land, and the land was part of them. And again, interesting to consider that all of us came from the dust of the earth. And so when we work the earth from which we came, and we do it within the parameters that the Creator has set down, then that land is going to be bountiful and it's going to produce for us. And perhaps, this is why so many people get attached to the land. It gets in them. It's part of them. And I believe that there is a spiritual principle that comes into play there. But at any rate, those who were compelled to sell because they needed the money or what have you, because the land was their permanent heritage, they didn't sell ownership of the land. Because once again, the land is the Lord's. The earth is the Lord's and all of its fullness, Psalm 24 says. But what they did sell was, or maybe even a better word is this, they leased it, and they leased it for crops. And so the person who would buy wasn't really buying the land. He wasn't buying the property. He was buying the rights to use the property as he saw fit to bring forth its fruit, to produce its crops. And so what we can deduce from this is that the stipulations that are placed down in the Torah are not so much for the protection of the property itself, but for humanity, for the protection of people, whether that be the people who were deeded that inheritance as a perpetual heritage, or even the folks that would buy, or shall we say, lease the property to be able to produce crops on it. Even though that's not their perpetual heritage, but even they are entitled to certain rights where that property is concerned. I hope that makes sense. It's not for the protection of the property, but it's protection of the humanity as it relates to the property. Now, in verse 11, we are told that you shall not sow in this year. So you're not to sow in the year of Jubilee as well as the Shemitah. And so, obviously, the Yovel shares some of the same features with the Shemitah. In verse 12, we see that the Yovel, like the Shemitah, is considered to be holy or set apart. You may eat of the produce that's in the field, just like in the Shemitah, but you may not store it. Now, here's something interesting to consider. That if every seventh year you have the sabbatical year, the Shemitah, and the land is to rest, and then you count seven of those sevens till you get to the 49th year, and then the 49th year would be a Shemitah, when the land would be resting. The next year would be Yovel, when the land would be resting. And so, for 2 years, actually, you have these rest times. You have one sabbatical year followed by another rest year. And so now you've got 2 years where men would be going crazy because they can't get out there and work, and the land's just sitting out there, and you're thinking, you know, this is not productive. I've got to do something. And yet what we see once again is what human beings would call being unproductive. The Creator, the one who created the land that we want to work, is saying, no, this is a necessity for your spiritual growth so that you can be productive in a physical and material world. Now, some of the laws of Yovel are what the text begins to discuss. And implied in these next commands is, if one allows greed to keep him from observing God's commands, here's what's going to happen. He's eventually going to lose his money and be forced to sell his movable property. If he's still unrepentant and still unwilling to follow God's commands, then he's going to be forced to sell his inheritance and his house. In other words, the thing that he didn't want to see to happen, and so he's trying to be quote-unquote productive so that that doesn't happen, brings about the very thing he sought to avoid. If he's still unrepentant, he's going to have to borrow with interest. And you'll see why we say this as we go through the Torah portion. If he continues to be unrepentant, he has to sell himself to another Israelite, or worse, to a non-Israelite, a Gentile. And lastly, if he's still unrepentant, he may even have to sell himself and become a servant of idols. So that's the progression of things that we see as we go through these laws of Yovel. Now, in verse 14, one of the things that it tells us is, in this time, as it relates to redeeming property, you shall not wrong one another. As a matter of fact, this Torah portion is very clear that we are always to strive to help your brother whenever it's possible. One of the highest forms of charity, it is said, is to help someone to make a living in an honorable way. In other words, you don't want them to be in a position to have to seek charity. And so if you ascertain that your brother is on a path that is going to place him in a position to seek charity, then what you want to try to do is to help him to avoid that. And one of the best ways is to help him make a living in an honorable way. In other words, not just to give him a handout, because most honorable people don't want a handout. They want a hand up. So that's essentially what it is sharing, or it is stating to us, or the principles that are coming forth from what we are told, and especially in these laws of Yovel. In verses 15 and 16, as it relates to redeeming the property, it says, according to the number of years shall you buy. Again, one does not purchase the land from the inheritor, but you actually purchase or lease the number of crops until the next Jubilee year. And so if the seller puts a price based on the value of the land and not the crops that it would produce until Jubilee, then he defrauds his neighbor. Because once again, the land is God's. And so only the produce that the land generated could be sold, not the land itself. So again, if you tried to place a value on the land, whether you are the inheritor selling it to somebody else, or you're the one wanting to that's supposed to sell it back to the original inheritor, if you try to place a value on the land, that is not being up front with your neighbor. That's defrauding your neighbor. But you're supposed to do it according to the number of years until the next Jubilee, or the number of years since the last Jubilee. In verse 18 and 19, it says, you shall dwell in the land in safety and eat until you have enough. Rather than fearing in those rest years, rather than worrying about what's going to happen in those years when you're supposed to rest, our obedience would bring plenty to eat and safety in those times. Because obedience to God results in not having to worry about where our next meal is coming from, or who's going to protect us. Because our obedience of God is realized in that we are going to be safe from the perils of famine, from drought, and from war. When we are obedient to God, just like the daily manna that fell in the wilderness upon Israel, they would have sufficient food to eat. Likewise, when we're obeying God, we'll have sufficient food to eat, even if he has to rain bread down from heaven. The psalmist says in chapter 37, verse 25, I have been young and am now old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his descendants begging bread. The key word there, though, is righteous. So obedience, again, means that we don't have to worry about where the next meal is coming from, or who is going to protect us. When we're walking in obedience, we don't have to be wringing our hands over such things, because Yeshua even commented on this principle in Matthew chapter 6, verse 25. He says this, therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air, for they neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? Which of you, by worrying, can add one cubit to his stature? So why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin, and yet I say to you that even Solomon in all of his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Now, if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Therefore do not worry, saying, What shall we eat? Or what shall we drink? Or what shall we wear? For after all of these things the Gentiles seek. For your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Or Bill's translation, Obey God, keep his commands, and you won't have to worry about where your next meal's coming from, where your clothing's coming from, who's going to care for you, who's going to protect you. He will take care of those things because he knows you need those things. But what he wants you to do is focus on keeping his commands. Because if we do that, he will do what he promised to do. In verses 20 through 22, we see that a blessing is placed on the sixth year's crop. That is the one leading into that last seven of the sevens. And it's going to last through that year, and it's going to last through the next year, which would be the Yovel, and it's going to last into the ninth year. That is when you would be possible for you to start sowing your fields again. So there is such a blessing placed on the sixth year's crop, if you're walking in obedience, that the harvest of the sixth year will last into the ninth year. So this exceptional crop of the sixth year then is compared to the double portion, the Lechem Mishnah, of the sixth day when Israel would go out into the wilderness and they would find that on the sixth day of the week that there was a double portion of manna, and that double portion would feed them the sixth day and the seventh day and go on into the next day. And so that sixth year crop lasted for 3 years until the Sukkot, or the Feast of Tabernacles, of the ninth year. So that in itself speaks of something that is supernatural. And if it's supernatural, that means that it's of the Creator. And so again, highlighting the fact that if we are obedient to Him, and whether it's the Shemitah, the Yovel, or whatever it may be, the principle would still be the same. If we obey His commands, if we are faithful to stand upright before Him and to deny ourselves and our evil inclinations and in deference to His will and His way, then He will be faithful to perform His word on our behalf. We won't go hungry. We won't go without. We may not have the things that we want necessarily, but we will always have the things that we need. Now, from this point, the scripture gets into particulars about the redemption of the land. In verse 23, again, we see that the land is not to be sold in perpetuity because the land is not ours per se, but the land is God's. In fact, he makes this point by speaking of Israel, that Israel are, quote, strangers and settlers. And he's talking about Israelis now, as it relates to how we relate to the land. It's not to be sold in perpetuity because ultimately the land is mine, God says. And in that regard, Israel is merely strangers and settlers. And the terms that are used there is gerim, gerim being the plural, stranger, toshvim, or toshav would be the singular, toshvim would be the plural. By the way, we don't have time to go into this, but that's the term that is used speaking of Elijah the prophet. Now, when Naboth is asked to sell his vineyard to Ahab in 1 Kings chapter 21, here's what Naboth says to the king. The Lord forbid that I should give the inheritance of my fathers to you. In other words, what he's telling the king is, in Bill's translation, the Lord has said that I can't do that. The Lord has commanded that I cannot sell my inheritance to you because it is not to be sold in perpetuity. Now, in verse 25, we see that responsibility is placed upon relatives of an impoverished seller to redeem it if at all possible. In other words, if someone who is the inheritor falls into a situation where he feels he must sell the land or the crops of the land to someone, because it is an inheritance of that family, then the other members of that family have the responsibility, if at all possible, to redeem the land for him. And that is so that the land may be returned to the family. And as long as a fair amount is offered, the present owner must sell it back to them or must allow them to redeem it. Now, here's a midrash on this. Here's something to consider. When we see the land of Israel being inhabited by those who say that it does not belong to Israel, then I would suggest that this principle that we just read of is why we have these feelings of why the land should be restored to Israel and why these other people who say it doesn't belong to Israel should not be there. Because it becomes the responsibility of the family to make sure that the one who has been displaced from the inheritance, that inheritance is redeemed so that the land can be returned to the inheritor. And as long as a fair amount is offered, then that person must allow it to be redeemed. Now in verse 26, it says this: if a man has no redeemer, if someone in his family isn't unable to do that, then homiletically, the rabbis say, this is where God gets involved. In fact, if a man has no redeemer, is alluding to God. Because you see, if there is no redeemer, there's only one solution to the problem, and that's God. Because if they have lost their inheritance, no man can bring them back to God. Spiritually speaking, if God's people have been displaced from their true inheritance, and that is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, nobody can bring them back to him except God himself. And so he must redeem them and bring them back. Israel went into exile. They were displaced from their inheritance, and no one could redeem them. Therefore, he had to redeem them. And of course, ultimately, we see this in the Messiah himself. But when they are in exile, and when they have been in exile, and as they are in exile, the land would lay fallow while they were in exile. Nevertheless, he was determined to redeem them. In verse 32, we see through verse 34, we see that the Levitical cities, those given to the Levites, they were given eternal rights of redemption. Of course, the Levites did not receive provinces like the rest of the tribes, but what they got were 48 cities that were scattered throughout the land. And these cities would be surrounded by a ring of open land that they could farm and till and harvest, etc. But because they were limited in what they were given as far as property, their cities could be redeemed at any time. Furthermore, the text tells us that their lands could not be sold at all. Now, in verses 35 through 38, the Torah portion moves into the concepts of helping those who are poor, helping those who are impoverished. And as I said earlier, according to rabbinical sources anyway, the highest form of charity is to step in and help prevent someone from becoming poor. In other words, not helping the poor, but to prevent them from becoming poor. Which occurs to me that in the United States, you've got a lot of people who say they want to help the poor. And that sounds very noble. But many of them, the way they want to go about it, is to impoverish people in order to make others less poor. So, in my opinion, that's kind of talking out of both sides of your mouth. You're wanting to make others poorer so that you can help those who are poor. Well, the Torah doesn't look at it that way. Yes, the Torah wants us to help the poor. But better yet, let's help them before they get poor. Let's help those who are on the track to become poor. Let's help them and intervene in that situation so that that will not happen. Now, understanding that we always have the poor. Yeshua said as much. And we do have the responsibility to help those who are in need. We have a responsibility to help our neighbor. We are our brother's keeper. But if we are truly going to be our brother's keeper, if we're truly going to love our neighbor as ourself, then we want to help those who are on the road to poverty to prevent them from being impoverished. Now, in verse 35, to kind of undergird this, it literally says this: if his means, literally, if his hand falters, then give him a hand. If his hand is faltering, then give him a hand. Here's a rabbinical parable to kind of underscore what we're trying to say here. If a donkey's load begins to slip, help it before the load falls off. Because if you do it that way, one person is sufficient to help. But if you wait until the load falls off the donkey, then it's going to require many more than one to put it back in its place. And this principle doesn't only apply to the Israelite, but it applies to the stranger among you as well. The ger are to be helped in the same manner. And so again, the principle is to love your neighbor as yourself. That applies to all of your brethren, to all of your neighbors. And so then the question, who is my neighbor? And according to the parable of the Good Samaritan, your neighbor is the one that you least expect. Because in the parable, it wasn't the priest, it wasn't the Levite, but it was the one that outwardly, anyway, people despised. And yet he was the very one who had a heart toward the oppressed. See, some people present themselves as being concerned about the oppressed and the poor. And then there are those who truly do have compassion for the oppressed and for the poor. That is your neighbor, and that is the one that you are to love, and that is the one you are to help if his hand falters. But if you do, according to verse 36, you are not to charge interest. The word that is translated interest here, neshech, literally means biting, because interest is seen as biting into someone's resources. So when you charge interest, you bite into his resources, and yet the amount of the loan isn't reduced, or it's reduced very little. And so those who would be tempted to do such, to bite into somebody's resources, are reminded that they had better fear God. You see, this teaches us that ultimately the resources we have are not ours. It's just like the land that he allows us to work isn't technically ours, but it's simply given as a gift for us to use that we may exist in this physical world. And likewise, the financial resources we have aren't really ours. It's simply on loan to us from God. So when another of his people are in need, through you and through me, he reclaims what is his to benefit those who are his. It's like the Shemitah. The land was to rest in part so that the poor of his people could find sustenance, and even the beasts of his creation could find sustenance. And so that we think is ours is really his. And at times and under certain circumstances and conditions, he reclaims what is his to serve his purposes. It's just that he chooses, or would rather, to do it through you and me in our obedience to his commands. Now in verse 38, he reminds us that he is the one who took us from Egypt, and therefore we are to accept all of his commands, even those that are difficult for us. And I would guess, and I'm making the presumption here, that one of those things that would be difficult to us is not charging interest of someone that we are giving a loan. Because a lot of people are going to look at it as, well, you know, I'm having to take away from my resources to give to you so that you can pull yourself up out of this hole that you've gotten yourself into. And so that ought to be worth something to me. But we are to remember that we are to fear God and to remember that he's the one who brought us up out of the land of Egypt. And those resources aren't ours in the first place. So remember, in other words, the callousness of the taskmasters, and how that they oppressed you every day and made it impossible for you to get up out of those pits that you were in. In other words, don't be like them. you don't behave like the rest of the world behaves. You behave the way my people are to behave. Now, we also see in this Torah portion that from God's point of view, His people, the Hebrews, are not to be permanent slaves. Slavery in the Torah is fundamentally different than in the other systems of the ancient world, or for that matter, even different than what existed in America in the 19th century. For instance, consider Eliezer, who was the servant to Abraham. We don't see Abraham beating this guy, and we have no reason to believe that he did, and we don't see him being mistreated and simply pushed out into the fields to work, but actually we see this man being treated with kindness and with respect. In fact, was very much trusted by Abraham. In fact, cruelty that resulted in a serious injury to a slave, according to the Torah, secured his freedom. And so if you wanted to get out of hand with your servant or your slave, and you did something that caused him serious harm, you just lost him. He's now given his freedom. So in the Torah, slaves are not slaves in the accepted sense of the word, because in the Torah we see that they do not lose their status in the community, but neither are they excused from keeping the commands of God. So ultimately, even the slave had to obey God rather than to obey man. So perhaps a better term would be indentured servants, because for a specific amount of time, they're not free to resign their employment. They can't just say, you know, I quit. Nevertheless, they are to be treated with kindness. They were to be treated with consideration. In fact, the master is responsible to take care of the servant and of his family. In verse 39, God warns them not to work them with slave labor. That is to say, or it is understood to mean, any kind of degrading tasks. Because the services that you are to use him for is skilled labor, yeah, working in the field to do what you need done, but not to just give him some degrading task that would say, you're less of a person than I am. In verse 40, it says that whatever the term of the service, when the Jubilee comes, he's free, regardless. And in verse 41, he will return to his family and to his ancestral heritage. And when he does, even though he's been a servant or slave or indentured servant, whatever word feels better to you, when he returns to his family and his heritage, he returns to all of his rights, all of his privileges, and to the position that he enjoyed prior to his servitude, and his experience as a servant is not to be held against him. He is not to be looked upon as anything less than what he was before this experience. And so what this says to me is that those of us who are in service to sin, and servants and slaves to sin, when we were redeemed by the Messiah Yeshua, those old things passed away. And we, though whatever our past lives may have been, we are not to be looked upon in that way anymore, because those things are passed away. We are no longer servants to sin, but we are servants of the Most High. Verse 42 kind of reiterates this and says, they are my servants, speaking of his people, taken from the land of Egypt. And so God's people are not to be treated like everybody else. In other words, they're not to be sold on an auction block. They're not to be degraded, because to do so would be to act as Pharaoh acted toward them, and Pharaoh was destroyed because of it. So in verse 43, he warns against those who would make his people serve with rigor. And of course, that word rigor is the same word that's used of the taskmasters in Egypt. Now, the ultimate degradation for an Israelite was to be sold to a non-Israelite. And in fact, if that happened, the kinsmen of that Israelite are encouraged to redeem him without depriving the owner of his rights. Now, we can make the argument that it wouldn't be necessary to do that if he had been helped before this happened. On the other hand, this is not to suggest that we should enable someone to be lazy and incompetent. Nevertheless, the scripture tells us that if this happens to your Israelite brother and he is sold to a non-Israelite as a servant, that you are to redeem him as soon as possible. And here's why. because the longer you let him stay, the more likely it is that he's going to assimilate into that non-Israelite culture. But you can't just go in and take him by force. And if this is in the context of living in the land of Israel, in other words, showing that Israel controls the country, the laws nevertheless must be fulfilled by all. The law is both for the homeborn and for the stranger. So the Torah doesn't allow the Israelites to go in to this non-Israelite and to take that Israelite servant from him by force. The law must be followed at all times. Now in verse 50, it tells us that you are to make a reckoning with his purchaser, because his purchaser is entitled to his rights too. Here's one of the things that rabbis comment upon this, and I thought was really kind of interesting, and I felt actually kind of clever. The reason that you would not go in and take this Israelite from a non-Israelite by force, but yet would reckon with him and give him an equitable redemption price, is because to steal from an Israelite is one thing, but to steal from a non-Israelite is worse. Because if you steal from an Israelite, he'll rail against you. But if you steal from a non-Israelite, he will rail against you, against the Torah, and against all of God's people. And in that, when you have those of the nations that take your transgression as an opportunity to desecrate or to disdain the Torah, to desecrate God and his people, then you are guilty of desecrating God's name. Remember when Jacob's sons went down to Egypt, not knowing they were conversing with Joseph, and they returned with their grain and they found money in their sacks. Jacob wanted his sons to return that money just as soon as they possibly could, because this is to demonstrate that to be perceived as thieves in the sight of non-Israelites is worse than to be perceived as such in the sight of Israel. So it's one thing to fight amongst ourselves. It's another thing when the fight amongst ourselves encompasses those who are outside the family. When we do things to desecrate his name in the sight of those who don't believe or who are not part of the body, then we have done far worse than if we had done it to each other. Now, this instruction to redeem the Hebrew from the non-Hebrew explains, I believe anyway, why the king who knew not Joseph came to power. Put simply, it's this. If that king had not come to power, Israel, in this case the servant, serving a non-Israelite, would have continued to assimilate into Egyptian culture. And so God, remember from earlier, if there is no one to redeem, God has to redeem them. Now his methods of redeeming were equitable. But nevertheless, he had to redeem them, because if he did not redeem them, then they would have continued to assimilate into Egypt to the degree that there would have come a point in time that there wouldn't have been an Israel. It would not have been distinguishable between Israel and the Egyptians, and they would have been lost forever in the mix that is Egypt. In the same vein, in verse 53, we see that an Israelite is forbidden to stand by and to watch a fellow Israelite be treated harshly. And so here's what come to my mind, is that maybe this is why Moses killed that taskmaster when he saw him oppressing that Hebrew slave. That's open for conjecture and debate, but it's just kind of an interesting thing to consider. Now, as we move into chapter 26, we have warnings against idolatry. In verse 1, it says, "Do not make idols." Assuming an Israelite is a servant to a non-Israelite, he says, "Do not make idols," because that would say that this one who is now servant to a non-Israelite should not try to convince himself that because his master serves idols, that he should also serve idols. In verse 2, it says to observe my Sabbaths, under the same assumption, an Israelite working for a non-Israelite. He shouldn't just say, well, because my master doesn't do it, then I don't need to do it either. To the contrary, that person should continue to keep the Shabbat. So even if you're under the servitude of someone, that is not excuse for us to surrender the virtues and the principles and the commands that are put forth to us in Scripture. We are to continue to abstain from idolatry. We are to continue to observe His Sabbaths. And these things, well, actually three things that are mentioned here in this Torah portion that we are to do even under the worst of circumstances. To avoid idolatry, because in doing that we acknowledge that He alone is God. To observe the Shabbat, because in that we acknowledge that He is the Creator. And number three, to revere His sanctuary. In other words, keeping the pilgrimage festivals, or keeping the feasts, keeping His Sabbaths. In this, Israel remains set apart regardless of what's going on around us. Because to not keep Shabbat is tantamount to idolatry, because in both of these things they deny His authority. And Sabbath observance includes observance of the seventh year, which is related to reverence for the sanctuary. Because you see, the temple was destroyed and the people were exiled for failing to keep the Shemitah. So, as always, what He is telling us is that we are to be set apart in spite of our circumstances. And throughout Vayikra and Leviticus and all these Torah portions, that is the primary point being addressed. That as His people, regardless of what's going on around us, regardless of what the nations are doing, regardless of what our neighbor's doing, we have the obligation and responsibility to remain set apart unto Him. Because He's holy, therefore we are to be holy. And so that brings us to the end of Behar. The next Torah portion is one of particular interest to me because it's my Torah portion, the Torah portion that was read when I was born, Mechukotai. But until then, thank you and shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.